Okay.
There we go.
We'd like to call this meeting to order. This is the meeting of the Central Region RAC Committee, which is a regional advisory committee. Before we get started, we'd like to recognize the members of the RAC board. Over here on your right, we have a new member. His name's Jacob Steele, and he's from the Confederate tribe of the Goshute Reservation out on the West Desert. He's representing them. Then we'll go to Sarah and let you represent yourself.
Larry Fitzgerald representing.
Richard Hanson at large.
Gary Nielsen, I'm the RAC chair. I'm the sportsman's rep.
Christopher Marble at large.
Tim Fair, also at large.
Mike Gates with the BLM.
George Holmes, agriculture.
Jay Price, elected officials.
Thank you, and also we'd like to recognize the presence of Calvin Crandall, one of our wildlife board members. We appreciate him attending our meeting and getting a flavor for the central region so he can help me take it back when we go back. Now, a couple of things, and you know this, but we're going to review it anyway. This is a public forum. You have the opportunity to express your ideas, and we encourage you to do that. The RAC will consider ideas and opinions, and then we will report them to the wildlife board. A couple of things about wildlife, as most of us are here because we feel passionately about it. We encourage you to express your opinions, but also respect those of opposing opinions. We'd like you to keep your emotions in check and allow individuals to freely express their opinions. As you entered the room over here, there was a table that had a copy of both the meeting's agenda, and it also had some comment cards. If you wish to make a comment, we would like you to fill out a comment card and put which number or item of the agenda that you'd like to comment on, and then when we get to the public comment period, we will call you out of the audience to come and make your comment. There's some kind of rules on speaking as far as time for each. What normally happens is for each of the items, a division will make a 10 to 15 minute presentation offering background information and then the division's proposal. At the end of that presentation, I'll ask the RAC if they have any questions or points of clarification. This is a time to just make sure they understand what was presented. Then we'll ask the audience if they have any questions or points of clarification. And again, this is just a time for questions and clearing things up. Once all the members of the audience have asked their questions, the period will be closed, and then we'll ask for public comment. And this is the point in time to where I will call you up if you filled out a comment card, and you will have your chance to talk. A couple of things on time. If you're representing yourself, you have 3 minutes. If you're representing a group, please state that group's name, and you have 5 minutes. If you're speaking for yourself, please introduce yourself as you come up. A lot of times, because we're going through the agenda and topics, please listen to the other comments so that if the stuff you need to say has already been said, then you can just agree with them or support them in their saying. Okay, get started off. Just a little wildlife board meeting update. I'll spend a couple of weeks ago. We went up and went through all of our proposals and stuff to the Wildlife Board. They considered all of them. Most of them moved through the process pretty easily. Most of them were supported. They modified a few of them. For example, on the amendment, and which was R657-45, which was the license and permit, the Northern Region made a stipulation to include veterans with disabilities and seniors, and that was the one you remember to purchase multi-year licenses, and that passed unanimously. The Hunter Mentor Program passed unanimously. The one to accept the rule with the fishing with more than one pole passed unanimously. The Aquatic Invasive Species Interdiction Rule, that's where they have the right to stop and check boats coming through, which is similar to what other states do, also passed. The bucks, bulls, and once-in-a-lifetime recommendations, there were a few small changes on that. They wanted to keep the number of trophy bucks on the Paunsagaunt and Henry Mountain units that they'd approved for 2013 as opposed to increasing them. The motion was made. It passed unanimously. The other thing they did is held steady on the amount of elk they were going to issue on the Manti unit. The antlerless permit recommendation went through a similar process. It was proposed motion was generated and it passed unanimously. They also talked about just permit numbers on the Southwest Desert. There was quite a bit of concern down there from some of the landowners, not the landowners, but the permittees that were grazing about the numbers of elk. And they are also, you know, there's a multifaceted thing going on there with the horses as well. They're also concerned about Monroe Mountain and some of those places and that they'd cut back on their grazing permits, but the elk were doing really, really well. So there was quite a bit of discussion about that. They did vote on that, and it passed, but only because the chair voted to break the tie. With the one other thing that was discussed that you'll see more about later was the wild horse issue on the West Desert, especially in the southern area, Indian Peaks area. The horses are eating everything out of house and home. The BLM is unable to or not willing to try and regulate the numbers. They figure the numbers are three times what they're supposed to be, and they defend the water sources, and out there on the desert, that's a serious thing. And anyway, so they're trying to figure out what they're going to do with that. You know, and it's a budget thing. It's expensive to try and catch the horses and get them out of there. So they're working on what to do. And they proposed a motion that they should take a good hard look at things and possibly reduce the number of big game permits out there as well, reduce the number of elk just to give the range a little bit of a break. And they said as they left that, they were going to wait till it got a little closer and see how summer unfolded and then call for some sort of action if that was warranted. The next thing on our agenda is a regional update, and that will be from Dr. John Fairchild, the regional supervisor.
Okay, we do have quite a long I'm gonna be brief. I'll go through it by section. In our aquatic section, we have a big project going on right now to move 50,000 yellow perch from Fish Lake to Yuba Reservoir. That'll be going on through May 23rd. Is this on? Okay. We'll involve a lot of angler organization, you know, volunteers and division employees and. Mike's right back from that, so you're right in the middle of it right now. So he'll be heading back down tomorrow. We completed the gill netting at Deer Creek and Jordanelle. Some of you probably participated in that. I believe they were not surprised by the findings. We're still not seeing the numbers of rainbows in Jordanelle that we'd like to see. So this summer, there will be a working group to reevaluate the management plan, update the management plan for Jordanelle, and some of you will probably be involved in that. June Sucker crew is out sampling Utah Lake, and there has been some spotted frog monitoring go on this spring. And anything to add there, Chris? Covered it. He'll have an agenda item later. In our wildlife section, we're wrapping up the sage-grouse let counts, except for strawberry, a little higher elevation. They start up later. In general, we're still very concerned about sage-grouse numbers, but as far as the counts go, and these are very, you know, general, Ibapar counts are up a little bit. West Desert, the counts are down. And Little Valley out there on the Sheep Rocks, it's significantly lower than in years past. And that's an annual monitoring where we're evaluating the number of males on the leks to get a trend in populations. Anything to add there, Terry? Okay. Pronghorn flights were completed over Easter weekend. Numbers are continued downward. The wild horse numbers were up considerably. They count those also. Mule Deer Management Plan Working Group convened. They're developing survey questions that are going to go out to in a survey that will be used in helping that working group come up with their updated Mule Deer Management Plan. So that's in the process. Our region has completed the deer unit management plans that we were expected to due this year. They're in Salt Lake for review. And we're starting range rides this week, this Friday. I believe Dale Lichty has one going up in Diamond Fork area. Dennis Sutherland will also have some range rides, so if anyone's interested in those, get a hold of those guys. In our habitat section, the end of the month, the Mule Deer Foundation is having their field and stream day on May 31st at our Santaquin Wildlife Management Area, and a lot of Mule Deer Foundation members will be out participating in conservation projects that benefit wildlife. Livestock grazing, we offer grazing on our spring range on wildlife management areas, and that'll take place in May and June. We have a bull hog project. That's basically a piece of equipment that chews up and spits out cedar trees. That's happening in Dairy Fork and on the Hilltop Conservation Easement in Sanpete County. And that's a selective treatment to increase forage on deer winter range and maintain important thermal cover for deer. West Vernon, 1,000-acre lop and scatter project where young juniper trees are being removed is taking place. Conservation, and that one definitely benefits sage grouse anytime you're thinning, pushing back the juniper pinion encroachment on sagebrush. That's increasing habitat for sage grouse. Conservation outreach. Today we had our Salem Pond fishing event day. I say ours. It's really a lot of agencies and organizations, Forest Service, you know, well represented. Pritchett's very well represented. We thank you again. SFW and just a lot of organizations. We're out with about 1,000 special needs kids, a lot of volunteers, a lot of people, to out showing those kids a good time. They look forward to it all year long. Shields fishing event is going to be held on May 17th. We have a Big Hollow shooting range open house on May 31st. Wasatch County guys. Utah Lake Commission field trips were completed. It's where a lot of school kids were given a variety of presentations on various resource values at Utah Lake. Patty, you were probably out there, weren't you? Good. In our law enforcement section, we'll be continuing with quagga checkpoints at various places at Lake Powell. And we still have vacancies in Juab and County, Heber, the CO districts there in Wasatch County, and they'll be filled in August. So, any questions from the RAC? What's that?
Thank you.
Did we skip over that?
Yes, we did.
Okay, well, it's back to you then.
Yeah, that's true. Okay. All of you had a chance to look at the agenda and the minutes. Is there any corrections that need to be made in either?
I move we approve them as presented.
Okay.
Second.
Motion made by George, seconded by Carl.
Chris,
sorry. All in favor? Could you do that one more time, please? Okay. All opposed? Okay. Motion passes. With that, 1, 2, 3, 4.
Are there corrections that need to be made?
Yeah, we're not sure it's an appropriate place to do that.
Well, if it's a problem with the minutes, now is the appropriate time. But if it's a problem with the decision, it's probably not.
I just think there were some things said that weren't in the minutes that weren't appropriate, and I think they were left out.
I think there was an off-the-cuff comment made by a RAC member that was not included in the minutes. If is that what you're referring to?
Okay, then I guess we've already decided the motion passed.
Okay. It's true. All right. We'll discuss it later. Thank you. Our first item tonight is an action item. It's a turkey management plan, and we have Jason Robinson, Upland Game Coordinator, to make the presentation for us.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. Okay, I'm Jason Robinson. I'm the Upland Game Coordinator. I'm based out of the Salt Lake City office. As you can see from the agenda, I've got quite a few things. So if everything goes well, you won't hear from me for a little bit, so bear with me tonight. The first thing I've got for you is the Utah Wild Turkey Management Plan. And so the Division of Wildlife actually has a current management plan that was approved by the board in 2000. Within that management plan, there's four goals. And much of the information was either outdated or we had met the objectives. The other big thing is we know a lot more about turkeys in Utah now than we did in 2000, which ultimately meant we needed to update this management plan. And to do that, we assembled an advisory committee to help us work through some of these issues. We had a diverse group that was participating in this revision. So we had DWR folks from the Salt Lake office, all five DWR regions, our outreach section, our habitat section. We had members of the National Wild Turkey Federation on there, both the state, regional, and national level. We had Sportsmen for Fish and Wildlife on there, Utah Chukar Foundation, BLM, Forest Service, Wildlife Board, RAC, private landowners, interested sportsmen, Farm Bureau. We invited the NRCS to participate, but they declined because of other obligations, as well as the United Wildlife Cooperative. So our meeting schedule, we began meeting in December of 2013. We had five total meetings. The last meeting was in mid-March to get this ready for the RAC process. We had 20 hours of meeting time plus our homework. So a lot of the work was actually done outside of the meetings, the writing and that sort of thing. And then we would get together and discuss. So the committee members did a lot of stuff outside of that 20 hours. So within this plan, we're recommending a six-year plan with a three-year renewal option. If at the end of that 6 years we feel like there's still stuff we can do, we would then just renew it for an additional 3 years. The reason we're going with a 6 and 9 is it syncs with the three-year guidebook schedule, which helps with our administration. Within the plan, we've got some background information, basic biology about turkeys, habitat needs, harvest background, and links to data. So as opposed to including a bunch of information that's dated as soon as we print it, we wanted to have the ability to folks looking at it 6 years from now to go to those links and get the most up-to-date information about harvest and other things. We also updated the occupied turkey habitat map for Utah. We've been expanding turkeys quite a bit in the state. So you can see the bright blue areas are where turkeys currently occur within the state of Utah. So within the plan, we have five goals. The first one is to maintain and improve turkey populations to habitat or social carrying capacity, minimize human-wild turkey conflicts, improve wild turkey hunting opportunities, enhance the appreciation of wild turkeys in Utah, and enhance interagency cooperation. So within the first goal, we have three objectives. So to stabilize populations that are declining, especially through catastrophic events, such as severe winters or large wildfires. We would like to increase wild turkey habitat by 40,000 acres statewide, establish wild turkey populations at 80 new sites. The second goal, we have two objectives, to decrease the number of chronic material damage complaints. And the reason that material damage phrase is used, that comes straight out of wildlife code through some legislation that was passed last year. So that's a legal obligation for the Division of Wildlife to respond within 72 hours. We would also like to decrease the number of chronic nuisance complaints. And an example of these two, material damage would be something like damage to agricultural crops by large concentrations of turkeys. Nuisance complaints might be there's too many turkeys in my front yard. So that's kind of the difference there. The third goal, we have two objectives. To increase accessible hunting areas within 1 hour drive of the Wasatch Front by 10,000 acres. Most of the state's human population lives along the Wasatch Front, so we felt that was the best opportunity to increase hunting opportunities. We would also like to increase the number of permits sold to 20% increase from the number of permits sold in 2013. So that's 11,680 is our goal. Under Goal D, we have two objectives. Increase targeted education. So one of the things we want to make sure that people are aware of is turkeys are native to Utah. There are species that we have archaeological evidence that they were here in Utah. And what a success story it's been. We've brought these birds back, and they're doing well in Utah, and we want to get that information out, as well as some of the other benefits of turkeys here in the state. And we would like to increase the number of participants at wild turkey events by 10%. So that could be viewing events, you know, national wild turkey events, SFW events, that kind of thing. And then the last goal, we wanted to increase interagency cooperation. So we're proposing to have 5 meetings per year, 1 in each DWR region per year with different agencies to kind of just cooperate and get on the same page with turkey management. Each one of those objectives have multiple strategies to accomplish, just to make that clear. That's all I had. Thank you.
Thank you, Jim. Points of clarification. Any questions or points of clarification from the audience? Seeing none, are there any comments from the audience regarding the presentation?
I filled out a comment card.
Okay, got here one. All right, Mike?
I'm Mike Pritchett. I represent Sportsmen for Fish and Wildlife, and I had the privilege to serve on this committee and be a part of it, and we put in 20 hours of work on that, and we really support it, think it's a good management plan, and it was a great effort by Jason and all the other people that are involved, and things went really well, and appreciate Jason and extending our offer for me to be a part of it, I'd like to recommend the RAC to support it and pass it. Thank you.
Thank you, Mike. Any other comments from the audience? Okay, we'll bring it back to the RAC. Yes?
Go ahead and make a motion to approve as presented.
Motion has been made to approve as presented.
Second.
We have a second. All in favor? Motion passes unanimously. Our next item is also an action item. It has to do with turkeys as well. It's a turkey transplant proposal list, and it'll be Jason Robinson's presentation as well.
Thank you. So I'm going to talk about the wild turkey transplant recommendation. So a transplant list for wild turkeys is required by Wildlife Code 23-14-21. We currently have a transplant list in place, but this new transplant list was sent through the RDCC and local governments. We did receive comments back from 6 counties. None of those counties had any opposition to this transplant list. We're still trying to grow wild turkey in Utah. That's a management plan goal A, so we are still trying to expand turkey populations in the state. The current approved transplant list expires June of 2014. Excuse me. So we are recommending a 5-year transplant list, which would mean it would expire June of 2019. This transplant list was developed at the regional level by local biologists with input from other folks in other agencies. We'd like to move these turkeys to areas with low likelihood of conflicts with people. And we also view transplants as a tool for reducing human-turkey conflicts, which falls under management plan goal B that you just approved. So this current transplant list, we have 235 total sites statewide. 106 of those sites are new, so there's not currently turkeys there. And 129 sites are existing sites that will be supplemented. So an example of that is the turkey population's low, or we need to increase genetic diversity there. Three-quarters of the sites are for the Rio Grande subspecies, and a quarter of them are for the Merriam subspecies. This is a regional breakdown of each of the sites being recommended. You can see the central region there on top with 80 sites, so that's the most of any of the regions, and half of those are new sites. So from that, you can see that some of our regions are just about full of turkeys, the northern region being an example. And some of the regions can still grow turkey populations, the central region being an example of that. Just to kind of give you an idea of the number of turkeys that we moved last year, just to give you a reference, last year through the winter, we captured and moved 805 turkeys within the state. So just kind of give you an idea of the number of birds we're moving. And that's all I had. Thank you.
Thank you, Jason. Are there any questions or points of clarification from the RAC? Any questions or points of clarification from the audience? Okay, Mike Pritchett, would you like to comment?
Again, Mike Pritchett with Sportsman Fish and Wildlife, and again, I worked with Jason through the management plan and also with the trap and transplant list, and it's a very good list, and we hope to help them financially and whatever obligations they need to help their objectives to fill those. And we'd like to let the RAC know we support it, and would like the RAC to support the transplant list. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Any other comments from the audience? Okay, we'll bring it back to the RAC for a motion.
I'm sorry, I have a question. I see there are several areas in Wasatch County that are listed for transplant. Of those, how many of them are new? Do you know? None are new.
If you look in the recommendation, sorry, I don't know off the top of my head. I'd have to look, but they're marked either as being new or supplemental. It's tough. They like thick woody cover, especially trees. So it's hard to get an exact number. A lot of the time in the winter, they'll get in large concentrations in areas where there's food. And that at least gives us some kind of index of a growing population or declining population. Really, it comes down to our biologists being out there on the ground seeing, but it's hard to do anything formally. An educated guess, I would say.
Richard.
Where are you getting the turkeys from to do the transplants, mainly?
The vast majority come from within the state. We do look to other states to get turkeys if they have a surplus. As an example, 2 years ago we got some birds from South Dakota in the Black Hills. They had a surplus. But the majority of our birds do come from within state. Like this year, all of them were caught within state and moved within state. A lot of them came from the northern region in areas where they have, basically they've met their social carrying capacity. So there's more turkeys than people want to see, especially in the winter months. So we go in and capture those birds and move them to areas where they won't be in conflict and where we can use some additional birds.
Can the audience
make a comment? Yeah, go ahead. Stand up to the mic, if you would, please.
After the transplants, what's the success rate in terms of survival? Is there any indication of that? Are these bringing them from the Dakotas into new habitat that they may not be used to?
We don't have exact estimates on what it is here in Utah. We know it's high because, the populations are expanding very well. We don't have an exact estimate on what it is, though.
Thank you.
Yes.
I move we accept the proposal.
Motion's been made by George. Is there a second? Second by Chris. All in favor? Motion passes unanimously. Our next action item is Upland Game Turkey Crane 3-year recommendation, and we'll be hearing from Jason Robinson.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. Just a clarification. I won't be covering cranes. They fall under migratory upland game birds, and Blair Stringham will be covering that with his agenda item.
Okay.
So moving into the Upland Game and Turkey Guidebook and Rule Recommendation, I'd like to start out with just a little bit of background on upland game. Whatever you know about big game, kind of throw it out the window. It doesn't apply to upland game. They're very different in their biology and how we manage them because of that biology. Upland game experience large boom and bust cycles. They're generally short-lived. A lot of upland game animals live less than 2 years. Most ringneck pheasants don't live to see their second birthday. So they're very cyclic. So they're largely dependent on annual production, so they have a lot of offspring to kind of offset those high mortality rates. Natural survival in a totally normal population can be as low as 10%, which means 90% of a healthy population can die each year. And it's quite variable from year to year. And hunter harvest generally accounts for less than 10% of the annual population. So a very small amount of birds actually being harvested by hunters. Again, population cycle largely independent of hunter harvest. We have a term we use, the law of diminishing returns, which influences hunter interest and persistence throughout the season. So what this basically means is in a year where we have a lot of, we'll use chuckers for an example, a lot of chuckers, a hunter will go out, have a great hunt, he'll go back and tell all of his buddies it was a great year. They'll go out, take advantage of that hunt. In contrast, in a year where the population's low, maybe precip drove that population to be low that year, that same hunter goes out, has a terrible hunt, goes back and tells his friends it was terrible, so they don't go. And so you kind of have this inherent protection. In low years, you have fewer hunters. In high years, you have more hunters. We also regulate harvest through long seasons and liberal bag limits. So to spread the harvest and opportunity out throughout the state and throughout the hunting public. So the reason I bring this up, kind of the take-home message is, for upland game, a 3-year guidebook makes sense biologically. We don't want to be trying to chase those highs and responding to those lows because they will eventually work themselves out. And so having a stable regulations actually helps with management. Moving into the actual recommendation, anytime you see that bright yellow color there, that's a change from the last 3-year guidebook cycle. So the first one we have here is we'd like to change our definition of youth. We'd like the definition of youth to be 17 years old or younger on July 31st each year, and that's consistent with the big game definition of youth. And it also offers more opportunity for youth. And you'll see that as kind of a common theme throughout this recommendation is opportunity. We want to increase opportunity. So moving into the species-specific recommendations, starting with quail, no change in the area or the season dates from the last 3-year guidebook. The one change we would like to recommend is we've had a single youth day hunt that opens before the actual general season quail hunt. We would like to increase that from a 1-day hunt to a 3-day hunt that would be Saturday, Sunday, Monday. And this will be, you'll see this pop up here a couple of times for different species. And really, we want to increase opportunity for youth, you know, with sports on Saturday, church on Sunday, school. It just gives the youth and the parent more opportunity to get out there and take advantage of the resource. No other changes for quail are being recommended. Moving into the partridges, chucker and gray partridge, we would like it to use the term gray partridge as opposed to Hungarian partridge. That's the correct name, so we'll be moving forward with that. Again, no change to the area or the season dates. Again, we would like to increase the 1-day youth hunt to a 3-day youth hunt, Saturday, Sunday, Monday, which would be prior to the general season in September. No other changes for partridge. Moving into cottontail rabbits, we are not recommending any changes from the last three-year guidebook. Dusky and rough grouse, again, not recommending any changes from the last three-year guidebook. Greater sage grouse. So we would like to continue a permit allocation based on population estimates. So you heard from John about the sage grouse let counts. What we do is we count the number of grouse in the spring, and then we make a recommendation of the number of birds to harvest for that fall based on that spring count. So if count numbers are up, it'll be higher permit numbers. If counts are down, it'll be lower permit numbers. Just to be clear about this, most of the state of Utah is closed to sage grouse hunting. We have four areas that are open, and within the statewide population, Utah harvests less than 3% of the statewide sage grouse population, so very little harvest. Some of the benefits of having a hunt, we get collect wings that provide us biological data that's helpful in management. Hunters are conservationists and they're advocates for the species, and so they're great allies to have for speaking out for the species. And then it also provides us funding, funding to do research, to conduct these surveys, that sort of thing. The one change we are recommending is to discontinue the 10% allocation to falconers. So in the past, a falconer could just go pick up a sage grouse permit. They didn't have to apply for it or anything. They just had to have a falconry license. And what we would like to recommend is that falconers now apply for a permit like everybody else does, and they'll have to draw that permit, and then they would be able to use their falcon as their weapon of choice. So no recommended changes to the areas, season dates, or bag limits. So a hunter that's successful in drawing a permit is only allowed to shoot two sage grouse per year. Moving into ring-necked pheasant. So we have a couple of minor changes here. So what we've had is essentially a month-long pheasant season. The first 2 weeks is statewide on all lands. And then what we had in the past was a hunt on state and federal lands where private lands were closed in select counties. And what we would like to do is open up those select counties to all counties. So the easiest way to think about this is a four-week season for pheasants with the last 2 weeks private lands being closed. The exception to that is walking access. So what that allows us to do is our state-owned properties, we've been putting out some pen-reared pheasants that have been a successful program, and it gives us a little more time and opportunity to allow people to go out and harvest those birds on our state-owned lands. And it also allows those private lands are closed as kind of a refuge area for those birds to go to. No recommended changes to the season dates. The youth hunt, again, we would like to expand that youth opportunity. In the past, we've had just the Saturday. We'd like to expand that to a Saturday, Sunday, Monday youth hunt closest to the 13th of October. And again, no changes to the bag and possession limits. Sharp-tailed grouse is done very similar to sage grouse. We count the birds in the spring, recommend a number of permits that fall. A hunter is only allowed to kill, if successful in drawing a permit, two birds per year. Again, a very conservative hunt for sharp-tailed grouse, and not recommending any changes from the last three-year guidebook in area, season dates, or bag. Snowshoe hare, we are not recommending any changes. White-tailed ptarmigan, again, not recommending any changes. Wild turkey. So we're not recommending any changes to the hunt structure with the limited entry, followed by youth, followed by the over-the-counter season. Still like to keep those management parameters in place, the 20% success, look at hunter crowding of less than 4 on a 1-5 scale, hunter satisfaction greater than 2 on a 1-5 scale. We would also like to recommend discontinuing the limited entry landowner permits. What we've seen by analyzing this data is of the 500 permits available to these landowners, on average 33 are being utilized, which is about 7% use rate. And it is a large effort for our field folks to go out and verify the acreage and the habitat. And it's also a large workload in the office to then allocate these permits. And what we found is that a landowner that has control over access to their property can buy an over-the-counter permit, and that's what most of them have done. We've seen a real shift once we offered those over-the-counter permits. So we're recommending discontinuing that program. And then we'd also like to offer a fall hunting season, a fall general season, in some limited areas, and I'll go into detail here in a second. So again, we're not recommending any changes to the hunt structure. So the dates of the limited entry, youth over-the-counter, and general over-the-counter permit. What we would like to recommend is to implement an annual limited entry permit allocation system. So it'd be very similar to the greater sage-grouse and sharp-tailed grouse. We would like the board to approve the process of the system that we use to come up with the permit numbers. And we wouldn't bring those permit numbers to you each year. But what I did provide for you here is an example of this hunt that just happened the spring of 2014. What the numbers on the left for each of the regions represents what our permit allocation system would have recommended versus what was actually recommended. And so you can see they're very consistent, but maybe some additional opportunity in some areas in the state. And the system accounts for hunter success, habitat area, if it's an increasing or decreasing population, similar to how we allocate permits for other species. And again, no recommended changes to the over-the-counter season. So the fall wild turkey general season hunt recommendation. So what we would like to do, there was some legislation passed two sessions ago that outlined some clear objectives for what the division the state would like to see the division do. And one of those was to have a fall hunt to help in reducing human wild turkey conflicts. And so one of the things is this fall hunt. And so just to be clear, fall hunts can reduce turkey populations. And so what we wanted to do is start with a conservative hunt. And so a person would apply for a region, and then there would be certain areas within that region that successful permit holder could hunt. The DWR regional staff would determine the areas, the permit numbers, and season dates within a framework of November 1st to February 28th. So they could be more restrictive within that season framework. And that would be determined annually. We would also use a permit allocation system. And again, we would like the board to approve the process. And what that does is it gives us flexibility to get these hunts where they need them, where they can do the most good. It does offer some additional opportunity, but again, the main objective is to help with those turkey conflict areas. We wouldn't have a permit point system in place, so it'd be random draw. The permit would be valid for any wild turkey, so male or female. 15% would go to the youth, and a person can have a permit for both the spring hunt and the fall hunt. And I put up there the recommended permit numbers for the fall of 2014. Two of the five regions are recommending a fall hunt. The central region is not. As you saw from the transplant list, we're still trying to grow turkeys here in this region. So the northern and southern region are the two that recommended a fall hunt. This is just an example from the northern region, kind of illustrating a person would apply for a northern region turkey permit. And anywhere in those bright green areas, they could hunt any one of those green areas. But not outside those green areas and not in a different DWR region. The season dates would be November 1st through December 31st. And the reason they stopped at the 31st is they felt after that point they could actually catch and move the turkeys to help us grow the turkey population in other parts of the state. And again, permit numbers would be 73 for the northern region. Our falconry recommendation, we'd like to stick with the September 1 through February 28th falconry date season. And those dates would be statewide. The hunts would actually occur within the recommended, within the guidebook. And then allow falconry on fall wild turkey hunts, but they must draw a permit. We have five board action items I'd like to present. We do not recommend allowing falconry on wild turkeys during the spring season, but allow for the fall turkey season. And the reason for the spring is as nesting females and broods, that sort of thing. We would recommend allowing shotguns from 10 gauge through 28 gauge to be used to hunt turkeys. I recommend allowing group applications for wild turkeys up to four. We would also recommend allowing youth hunters that are unsuccessful in harvesting a turkey during the spring limited entry hunt to then be able to continue hunting for the youth over-the-counter and the over-the-counter general. So if they didn't harvest a bird with the limited entry tag, they could continue hunting through the rest of the spring season until they either harvest a bird or it's May 31st. We do not recommend allowing the same program for adult hunters, so it just be limited to the youth. And then we also recommend allowing crossbows to hunt wild turkeys and upland game, which is consistent with some of the other weapon choices and changes that we've seen in big game and other hunts. So rule 657-6, which is taking upland game, we did make some minor adjustments in wording and corrections. We corrected some of the species names. An example, blue grouse are now known as dusky grouse. We'd like to call Hungarian partridge, gray partridge, that sort of thing. Adjustments to legal weapons, clarification and consistency on the use of dogs on our wildlife management areas. We added American crow in the list of migratory upland game birds. I'm not going to cover that proposal. Just want to make it clear that it would be added to this rule. If approved, Blair Stringham, migratory game bird coordinator, will be presenting the proposal for the recommendation for American crow. Rule 657-54, taking wild turkeys. Again, we made minor adjustments in wording. We removed the landowner permit section, adjustments to allow falconry, adjustments to legal weapon, and again, that same clarification and consistency on the use of dogs on wildlife management areas. That's all I have. Thank you.
Thank you, Jason. Are there any questions or points of clarification from the RAC?
So, I'm just, this is more out of curiosity than anything, but the proposal for a fall hunt, what was the purpose of that? Was that to increase hunter opportunity as opposed to just transplanting, trapping and transplanting birds? Was it a timing issue?
Kind of all of the above. Not every circumstance can we go in and actually capture the birds. We wanted to increase turkey hunting opportunity. In some areas, we really do need to probably reduce the population. So it allowed another tool for us to use, having these hunts. It can reduce the population if we wanted to. It increases opportunity. And it still allows us, as you saw in the Northern Region's recommendation, to still be able to move some birds if we want to. So it really just gives us more options, management options, to deal with our growing turkey population.
Okay, thank you.
Richard. I'm kind of aware of a couple of places in the Central Region where turkeys are kind of a problem for some people. And I wondered if that's not going to be an issue, or are you just going to go trap them, or what are you going to do then?
We'll probably go and capture those birds. We've been actively catching birds. You know, this last year I can give you the number of birds Central Region moved. 228 turkeys within the region were moved. So the region felt that this time the better recommendation would be to capture them and move them as we're trying to fill those sites that were approved earlier.
The problem is that some of those sites that you're going to try to increase the bird numbers are near those areas. And if you don't kill them, they're just going to keep coming back in there. So I'm just wondering, just from a management point of view, would it be better to just kill them and put pressure on them and move them away?
So we do have other options. You know, we do have a spring season hunt that can help us with that. We also have what we call a depredation hunt, which is in areas where they're causing damage. We can do a very specific kind of remove individual birds. So that is still an option for the region to utilize that.
Yeah, I really like this fall hunt, and I hope that that'll expand into all the regions eventually.
I think it will.
Any other questions or points of clarification? We looked at that, and I'm familiar with the areas he's talking about that have lots of turkeys, and that would be a real easy time to cull the population if it was beginning to be a problem.
And one of the things we've learned is once you start hunting turkeys, they're smarter than people give them credit for. You probably see that in the spring hunt if you hunt turkeys in the spring. They get quick, smart quick, which is kind of what we're hoping to do, is put a little bit of wildness back into them in the fall so they're not relying so much on people.
All right. Thank you. Any questions or points of clarification from the audience? Okay. Any comments from the audience? Mike, you're up.
Again, Mike Pritchett with Sports and Fish and Wildlife, and we do support the recommendations that the DWR is making in the guidebook. There's a couple items that I'd like to rack, to entertain, and look at. One being the youth hunt on the turkey, extending it from the 3-day to possibly 5 days. And turkey hunting, as you well know, it can be dictated enormously by weather. And this year was the prime example. The kids' youth hunt just was a wash. The weather was horrible. So, with the religion and Sundays, I feel we're realistically giving the kids 2 days to hunt. And I'd like to ask the RAC to entertain giving the kids 5 days. All it's going to do is just put the general season starting on a Wednesday. And I don't think that's a big hurt to anybody. And this isn't on there and talked about, but we don't currently offer a reduced license for our youth for our turkey hunts, and our current price structure is $35 for anybody to get a tag, and I'd like to see that looked at and possibly adjusted for the youth to get a discounted license in the future. I know our surrounding states all offer discounted youth turkey hunt licenses, so I think we need to look at it as our state to offer that too, and help grow our youth population, or our youth, and get them encouraged into participating in the turkey hunting. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mike. Any other comments from the audience? Okay, we'll bring it back to the RAC. Chris?
Going back to Mike's comments there, and probably either one of you can answer it. Was the youth hunt going from 3 to 5 days addressed in the turkey management plan that was put together?
It wasn't. We do have a strategy in there to try and optimize season lengths, but we didn't go into that fine of detail. And just a point of clarification, just so you're aware, a youth can hunt the youth hunt for the 3 days, and then they can then hunt the rest of the over-the-counter season. So what Mike's proposing would give them 2 additional days before the rest of the hunters go out there. Just clarification. Thanks.
Is there any concern with that, or any?
It's inconsistent. So we're recommending 3-day youth hunts for the others. It does shorten the over the counter season for the rest of the hunters a little bit, 2 days. But biologically, I don't think that there's really a concern.
But it would curtail the general season by 2 days if you were to extend it.
I
wouldn't just make it earlier 2 days and keep the general season. You'd have to shift the whole thing. Is that what you're saying?
You could recommend. I wouldn't recommend moving the tail end into June. Then you get into some issues with broods and that sort of thing. So the easiest solution, I guess, would be to reduce the hunt by 2 days. And so just take away 2 general season days and give the youth those days. And so they have them to hunt already. It would just reduce the number of adults out there.
And sorry, one more question. His other comment was about discounted turkey tags. Is there any reason why you don't have discounted turkey tags today?
Not that I know of. It's a pretty involved process to get the license dollars changed. But again, the turkey plan that was you guys passed earlier has a recommendation, a strategy to look at the current pay structure to see if we can offer some, if it is optimal, and maybe this would be part of that.
So it sounds like it's already addressed there in the management plan.
It's addressed in the fact that we would take a look at it, but right. It doesn't specifically say we would offer a youth reduced price.
Which is probably all we could recommend anyway. Here. Okay, thank you.
Anything else in the RAC? Entertain a motion.
I'll make a motion to accept the proposal as presented.
Motion made by Richard. Seconded by Chris. All in favor? Motion passes unanimously. I have to do that each time. But I just start and end the meeting with that thing.
I just thought I'd do it. There were a few people in the back row that were starting to fall asleep.
Okay.
It's too much Jason Robinson, probably, putting him to sleep.
He's quiet.
It's, yeah, it is. All right. Well, our next item is also an action item, R657-46, Use of Game Birds Rule and Amendment, and that will be presented by Jason Robinson, the Upland Game Coordinator.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Appreciate you guys hanging in there with me. Hopefully this one will be a quick one here. So this is Rule 654-46, the use of game birds in dog field trials and dog training. So this is a rule that's currently in place. We would like to extend that rule for an additional 5 years. Again, we corrected the language for the species, those same things I talked about earlier. Blue grouse are now dusky grouse, those kinds of things. And then we also wanted to make this rule consistent with the upland game rule that you just approved, the wild turkey rule, and also the waterfowl rule on the use of dogs on our wildlife management areas. So this rule will then just reference those other rules as clarification and consistency. That's all I had. Thank you.
Thank you, Jason. Any questions from the rack? Richard.
The birds you're talking about, are those domestic birds or pen-reared birds that they would use to do this?
In most cases, it's pen-reared game birds or waterfowl, so pheasants that are raised in pens, chuckers, that sort of thing.
Okay, so they're not allowed to use wild birds?
You can train your dogs on wild birds, and the rule kind of outlines when that's appropriate and when it's not. But you can use wild birds.
Okay. Any other questions, points of clarification from the rack? Questions or points of clarification from the audience? Questions or comments from the audience? I have no cards. Okay, we'll bring it back to the rack. For potential motion.
Make a motion to approve as presented.
Motion made by Chris. Seconded. All in favor? Motion passes unanimously.
Thank you.
Thank you, Jason. Our next item is an action item. It's a waterfowl recommendation, and it also involves cranes, and it will be Blair Stringham, the waterfowl coordinator.
All right, thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Blair Stringham. I'm the Migratory Game Bird Coordinator, and tonight I'll be presenting the Migratory Game Bird Recommendations for 2014-2015 hunting season. So I want to just give a little bit of background as to why we've moved the waterfowl recommendations to May rather than keeping it in July like we had in the past. The way our system works for waterfowl recommendations is we go to a summer flyway meeting, and that's typically in the month of July. We'll meet with states from across the flyway and the Fish and Wildlife Service and formulate our hunt recommendations for the year. At that point, it goes to the Fish and Wildlife Service. They have a committee called the Service Recommendation Committee. They let you typically approve or not approve of what recommendations that have gone through the flyway process. And if they are approved, they're put in the Federal Register, and at that point, they become legal for us to implement our waterfowl hunting seasons. And so typically, this date is put in during the month of September, but oftentimes, because of time constraints, the Fish and Wildlife Service is really coming up to a deadline of when they have that published and when hunting seasons begin. And so there's been some years where it's been right up till the final day before a hunting season occurs, before those have been published. And so because of those time constraints, the Fish and Wildlife Service would like to move their process back to the month of March to give them additional time to get things in the Federal Register. And so what that means for us is that it gives us additional time both to work on our guidebook and get it ready for the hunting season in the fall, as well as to coincide the waterfowl recommendations with the migratory game bird recommendations and essentially do one bird package of the RAC meetings like we're doing right now. The one caveat to that is that the Fish and Wildlife Service doesn't anticipate having their process in place until probably 2015-16. And so because of that, we don't have the current frameworks or preliminary frameworks from the Fish and Wildlife Service this time. And so the caveat for this presentation and presentations until that process is in place is that we would go with the most liberal option provided by the Fish and Wildlife Service. So meaning the largest bag limits or season lengths whatever offered to us, which we will know in a couple of months. And so I wanted to give just some brief background right now on some of the populations and habitat conditions and how they're looking this year. This is an outlook of spring precipitation for 2014, and for the most part we got water really in all the key waterfowl production areas. For the most part, our ducks tend to come from the Canada-U.S. border in the Prairie Powell regions, around that number 8 and up into number 2. So for the most part, we received excellent water conditions to good waterfowl or water conditions this year, and so what that translated into is great breeding habitat this year for waterfowl. Looking at our duck population data, last year was the second highest recorded number of waterfowl or ducks that we had on record. So for the most part, our duck populations are doing great across the North American continent, and we would expect another strong fall flight this fall. For Canada geese, this is our midwinter survey data. It's a survey that's done each winter in the Pacific Flyway. And you can see from the trend we've had increasing goose numbers across the Pacific Flyway since the 70s. And we have an excellent, really strong goose population here in the Rocky Mountain region. For tundra swans, this is another midwinter survey that we do, and you can see that the trend for them is similar to Canada geese. Seen increasing birds since the 60s, and so we have a really robust swan population as well here in the Pacific Flyway. And so to get into a little bit of background of how our waterfowl recommendations are calculated, they're largely based on the mallard population in the western part of North America. So whatever the mallard population is doing, we have three different options that we can have for season limits. If we have a really, really large population, we'll have that most liberal season, which we would anticipate is what we would have again this year, which will be a 107-day season and a bag of 7 birds. There are several duck species that do have species-specific management strategies for them. That's pintail camelsback and scop. And we would anticipate that seasons will be similar to what they were last year with a 107-day season and 2-bird bag for pintail. 107-day season and 1 to 2 bird bags for camelsback, and then an 86-day season for scop and a bag of 3. But those are under, could possibly change depending on what the flights are doing or the breeding bird survey shows us that's currently occurring right now and in the month of June. So what our waterfowl season recommendations would be, for our general season, it would start on October 4th and go till January 17th. That would be the statewide hunt. If we did have a shorter season for any of those three species, which we would expect probably for scop this year, we would have it start on October 4th and run until December 27th, which would be the maximum number of days. And then our bag limits and possession limits for ducks, mergansers, coot snipe, and falconry would all be similar to what they were in years past. We are recommending two small changes to our goose zones for dark geese. For the northern zone, we would like to include Locomotive Springs Waterfowl Management Area, which is on the northern shore of the Great Salt Lake. Include that in a northern hunt zone and just make things a little bit easier logistically. We'd also recommend making some small changes to the urban zone. Last year, we had it recommended as being the county boundaries for Davis, Salt Lake, Utah, Weber, and Washington counties. This year, we'd like to exclude Washington County. There really wasn't much of a difference in hunter numbers or really hunter satisfaction in those areas. For the rest of that zone, we would like to make them specific roads and highways that occur in the zone around the county boundaries. Made it a little bit difficult for people to identify where the boundaries were, so this would just make it a little bit easier for people to identify if they're in or out of the zone. The only other change we'd make for dark geese is to increase the bag from 3 to 4 this year, which would increase the possession limit to 12. For our light goose hunts, we're not recommending any changes. They're similar to what they were last year. For swans, they'll be similar as what they were as well. Same hunt area around the Great Salt Lake and the same number of permits. We are keeping our youth day as 16 or younger, which we've had in the past. That is consistent with some of the other hunts like the upland and big game. We ran into a few logistical constraints with the Fish and Wildlife Service, and so for this time we have to keep that at 15, but we will look for opportunities to increase that when we can. Another change we're making this year is to keep the shooting times consistent all across the state for opening day, which would be a half hour before sunrise opener, go till official sunset. In the past, we've had a delayed opener till 7, made hunters wait till 7:30 before they could shoot in Davis, Weber, and Salt Lake counties. For the most part, that just led to a lot of citations for people shooting early and a lot of frustration among our hunters, and so we would recommend just keeping it consistent across the state, which will be easier for people to understand when they can and can't shoot. So transitioning from waterfowl into the migratory upland bird species, for our dove hunts, we do have an opportunity this year to expand our dove hunts. The Fish and Wildlife Service did a 10-year evaluation of dove populations and found that, for the most part, dove harvest is, or dove hunting is underutilizing the mourning dove populations and white-winged dove populations. And so we've been allowed to extend our season by 30 days and increase the bag to 15. And so because we can't move it forward any into August, because of the Migratory Bird Treaty Act, we'll put those dates on the end of the season, which would extend it till October 30th and increase the bag till 15. And we are also recommending dove hunting to occur in some of our waterfowl management areas in the state. We haven't done that in the past, but it would allow for additional opportunities in some of our small wetlands outside of the Great Salt Lake Complex. For band-tailed pigeons, we're not recommending any changes this year to that season. It would be the same as it was last year. For sand-tailed cranes, we're not recommending any changes as well for that population, just to note that those permits are set through the flyway process on an annual basis. And lastly, we're recommending a crow hunt this year. And I wanted to first start out with a little bit of background information on crows, kind of explain why we're doing the hunt, where the population's at, so you guys can make a better educated decision on that. So our crow population in Utah, and this is our breeding bird survey data from across the state, we really didn't notice crows really at all until about the 1990s. So when we first started detecting them on our breeding bird survey transects. And as you can see, since then, we have seen an increase in the crow population. The numbers on the left just indicate a trend, so we don't have an actual population estimate of crows, but we have seen them increasing steadily since about 1990 or so. And so as far as the number of states that currently have crow hunting seasons, it's something that's been done for quite a while across the United States. There's only 4 states in the lower 48 that currently don't have crow hunting seasons. And of those 4 states, they do have more lenient depredation restrictions, which we currently don't allow for take of crows, even for depredation reasons here in Utah. And so some of the issues that crows are causing, we've seen some damage and been able to document damage to corn, grain, and some of the nut and fruit crops across the state. There has also been documentation of some livestock damage, particularly to young livestock, sheep, lambs, and calves, similar to what we've seen with ravens in other parts of the state. We have documented some nest predation on upland and waterfowl nests, as well as other ground and tree nesting species. And then one of the major complaints that we get are complaints from the roosts that occur along the Wasatch Front. Some of these roosts can have upwards of 500 to 1,000 birds at the roosting sites during the peak of their migration. That causes a lot of noise, a lot of concerns with droppings, as well as tree damage. And that has led to several diseases that are spread by crows. TGE is a digestive tract disease that's spread in swine, avian cholera, and histoplasmosis, which is earth spores that are found in the fecal matter, which cause respiratory diseases in humans. And so lastly, I just wanted to kind of point out how many bird species we do have in Utah. We're not trying to declare war on every bird in Utah. It's really just one of 32 species that we currently hunt in Utah, which is less than 8%, and only 32 of the 400-plus species that occur here in Utah. And so what our season dates would be for this new season, it would be September 1st through the 30th, and then restart again December 1st through the 28th. This would coincide when we have the most numbers of hunters out in the fields for the dove hunt as well as for the waterfowl hunts. It'd be a statewide hunt, have a bag limit of 10, a possession limit of 30. All rules for upland migratory birds would apply, so similar like doves, cranes, band-tailed pigeons. Hunters would be required to have plug shotguns, follow the shooting hours, half hour before sunrise to official sunset, and everything else that applies for upland game birds. And also be required to have a valid hunting license, as well as to retrieve and remove any crows that were harvested from the field, just like they would any other hunted species. In addition to the hunting season, we'd also like to open up our depredation a little bit more and add crows to that list for depredation reasons. The way that that's outlined from the Fish and Wildlife Service is they allow us to have a crow hunt as well as to take them for depredation and nuisance reasons. And so this would be something that would be afforded to people who are having depredation or nuisance issues across the state, really at any time of the year, as long as they were doing it in those specific locations where the problems were occurring. It doesn't require anybody to have a permit, so they don't have to have a hunting license, but there are reporting requirements to the Fish and Wildlife Service, and they would have to report the number of crows that were taken each year to the Fish and Wildlife Service in January after the season had ended for taking them. So lastly, just a few rule changes that, just to summarize some of those, we're looking to allow crossbows as a method of take like we have for upland and big game, as well as clarifying consistency on our dog uses on WMAs. And then to our CITP rule, we'd like to modify that to allow crows for depredation reasons, so include those with the list of birds we currently have and can be taken for depredation and nuisance. That's all I have. Thank you.
Thank you, Blair. Any questions or points of clarification from the RAC? Larry.
How are you going to distinguish between crows and ravens?
I guess, yeah, great question. So most of the states around us that have ravens also currently have a crow hunting season. They've provided a lot of literature in their upland game guidebooks, as well as things that they published, put on their website, put out pamphlets, things like that, just to show some of the behavioral differences with crows and ravens, as well as some of the physiological differences. So for the most part, you tend to see crows as being in large groups. They're also smaller in size than ravens and have different shaped tails. And so there are some key things like that.
Include the ravens and the crows?
No. So currently the Fish and Wildlife Service only gives us the option of crow hunting and depredation, taking them for depredation reasons. Because ravens are also covered under the Migratory Bird Treaty Act, they have jurisdiction from the Fish and Wildlife Service, and they don't offer any of those options currently for ravens.
I think most people consider a raven a crow, and those are the ones that people are going to go after.
Yeah. And so, I mean, what we hope to do is to publicize a lot of information that there are, some definite differences between the two. We have the basic assumption of all of our hunters that if they go out and participate in hunting, that they're going to be able to identify their target and put in some background information. And so, it's likely that some people won't, but we hope that most people will, and we definitely are going to provide all the information we can for those people.
Sarah.
So we've had a lot of opposition to this. I mean, a lot of folks have written in and let us know that they don't agree with adding the crow into this new rule. Do you think are they getting the two confused? Are they lumping the ravens and the crows together? I mean, what?
I think what's been seen, at least the comments that I've received, has been mostly just, more anti-hunting sentiment than anything. We have received quite a few comments as well, people who are excited about the crow hunt, particularly people who aren't from Utah who live back east where crow hunting has been going on for quite some time now. And so really the feedback I've been getting has been both positive and negative, but really probably not any more so than one than the other.
Chris?
On the damage that these crows are causing, do you have solid data evidence that we're really seeing damage caused by crows? What is the source of that?
A lot of it's come from just the number of complaint calls that we've had. Wildlife Services typically fields a lot of these calls, specifically in the Layton area. There's huge numbers of birds, and so they have had quite a few issues around Hillar First Base and in that general vicinity, which they have documented too.
Thank you. I'm just curious, are those, they go up and look at those cases and document it, or is it just purely the amount of complaints that they've got?
It's definitely largely most based on the number of complaints that we've got. We do have some limited, you know, data on what we've documented, but it's largely just based on number of complaints that we've had. So well, most of it's just anecdotal evidence.
I know one of the reasons they get after them in other states is the damage to bird nests. You know, the upland game as well as the waterfowl, they're just really hard on eggs, are pretty devastating on those kind of things. And so they've, is that, are they taking that into consideration? Is that in part of their thinking, or are they, besides agricultural and the nuisance?
Yeah, I mean, they've definitely been documented to be nest predators. They're corvids, and so they are really smart birds. We have seen definite increases in population around Farmington Bay and Ogden Bay, some of those, you know, production areas we have on the Great Salt Lake. We haven't collected any data on that, but, you know, the increase in numbers would suggest that there are likely some nests being destroyed, like crows.
Okay. Any other questions or points from the rack? Questions or points of clarification from the audience? Is this a comment or a question?
Just a question.
Okay.
I'm Rod Andrew, just representing myself, a duck hunter. The white goose hunt in February, March, is there any consideration about lengthening that out? Seems like we're having a tough time hitting when the geese are coming through, and I know that they're causing a fair amount of damage.
Yeah, so we've really maximized our season dates as much as possible to coincide when light geese are here in the state. Typically, we see a couple thousand geese that will come through in the fall, so we've tried to push that season date back from our general hunt to be about the time period when they come through, October, November, first part of December. And we've also split that season to coincide when they return from their wintering grounds heading north, which are those last few weeks of February and March. The restrictions we do have, though, do come from the Migratory Bird Treaty Act, which doesn't allow us to have a hunting season beyond March 10th. And so currently we've put it as far back as we possibly can to try to catch those birds moving back north. But there are growing concerns with agricultural damage as well as, you know, habitat conditions up in the breeding ground. And so as we collect more data, it may be a possibility to extend it, similar to what the mid-continent population has done with the conservation order and moving the hunt dog to April.
Any other questions from the audience? Okay, see none, we'll open it to the comment period. Our first request is from Margaret Wayne.
It's Wynn, Margaret Wynn.
Okay.
I live in Harriman, outside Harriman, and I've had a lifelong passion for birds and I'm an active birder. And I have a particular soft spot for corvids. I was hoping some other birders would be here. Hopefully there are that can talk to corvids. Okay, good. But they're highly intelligent animals, very resourceful, cooperative creatures, and they're commonly known as the most intelligent of all birds. They manufacture and use tools, solve problems, communicate dangers to other flock members, and participate in alec preening, which is grooming of other members of the flock. A recent study at University of Washington found that they do facial recognition of human beings that are a danger to them, and they pass it down several generations and within several miles of their territory. Parental care is very prolonged in corvids in general. A juvenile corvid will spend 2 to 3 years. A crow, American crow, will spend 2 to 3 years with its parents, and it will help take care of the younger brood. So it's hard to see how a parent corvid would have would do as well as they do without those younger birds. They discovered recently, pseudo-recently for scientific matters, that American crows live in cooperative groups, and that provides you an opportunity to compare them with primates, in that all of these characteristics I've listed are the same that you would consider as being of a higher mammal order, is caring for young and staying in social groups and having territorial behavior and all of that. Speaking of primates, this is all related. George Schaller and Jane Goodall all recognize that the study of animals is best suited when they're not feeling threatened. So if they're crows, which considering we're still making scientific discoveries on them, if they're being threatened, then the case can be made that we would not be able to make any scientific discoveries on them, or less than. Because of West Nile virus, there's been a 45% decline in American crow populations since 1999. And back east, it's been worse. And around Baltimore and Washington, there's been a 90% decline in population. So it may be that the American West is the last refuge for American crows. The other concern that you brought up was about the impact to ravens. And I have some pictures here that show juvenile ravens versus a crow. And you can see they're very difficult to tell apart.
They're really not difficult to tell apart if you know what you're looking at.
Well, in the time it takes to raise a gun from your hip to your shoulder, it might be a flutter of black wings. Can you see? Okay. The question is, you know, how quickly can somebody determine, does it have a wedge-shaped tail, is it shorter, is it longer, compared to what, if there's nothing else to compare it to? And I've seen on the other states, Arizona, Utah, Nevada, Colorado, they're educational, how they educate the hunters, and it's usually an inset in their guidebook that is not very descriptive of the difference between a crow and a raven. So I think that there would be a large impact on ravens, which is protected, as you said, under the Migratory Bird Act. And the other thing I've seen is in your press releases, it was mentioned that there's the main reason behind this was not so much about fruit crops or anything like that. It was about providing extra hunting opportunities in Utah as opposed to the neighboring states. And while it's true that the neighboring states do provide crow hunting, the season that we're promoting or putting forth is actually longer than the other states around us, except for Nevada. And if you look at the hunting opportunities that are already out there, bird hunting opportunities, there's already the Eurasian collared doves, which is all year long, 365 days a year. Utah has the highest amount of hunting opportunities for birds. They have 1,806. This is not counting youth hunter days or falconry or anything like that. Wyoming has 866, Nevada has 980, Idaho has 771, Colorado has the closest at 1,103, and Arizona at 399. So even at that, I think there's more than enough hunting opportunities for bird hunters, and there's 49 million birders out there in the U.S. spending $55 billion a year on looking at live birds, so I would recommend that we try and capitalize on that instead. That's it.
Okay, thank you. When you're speaking for yourself, please introduce yourself. Also, you have 3 minutes. If you're speaking for a group, you'll have five. Okay, our next comment is Wayne Whaley.
I may need him help with that computer. Scott?
Blair.
Your presentation is My name is Dr. Wayne Whaley, Utah Valley University, professor of biology, ornithologist, and I've studied raptors most of the time. Can I move this thing down a little bit? I've done several studies on raptors in various places in Arizona from a master's degree and also here at in Utah. I consider myself fairly good at being able to identify excuse me, I need a drink of water, but no water here. But by the way, I'm representing Utah County Birders.
Okay.
There's going to be a problem recognizing a crow and a raven. As an ornithologist, I have problems with that, especially on a short notice thing when you only have a very short time to see the bird. And so I agree with her 100%. There will be raven shot illegally in the state of Utah if we do this. But I want to go here now to some things that I've written down here. And when you get old, you have to have reading glasses, you know. First of all, I'm going to present three
DWR inferences that have been made about this proposed crow hunt, and then I'm going to make comments on those inferences. I'll start with most of these are right from the DWR website, and I'm going to quote Blair Stringham for these, since that's where I've taken them from. Crows damage fruit crops in Utah. I need the data. Where are the data? Before we can go shoot these birds, we need data. It's unethical to do this without the data. We need to know what we've got here before we can go shoot crows. They are more common in the northern part of the state, yes. So I've called the Logan office for the Utah Department of Agriculture and talked with them, asked questions. There have been no reports of crow damage to crops. Crows were not mentioned, but geese, sandhill cranes, raccoons. In fact, raccoons are probably the biggest problems on wildfowl in the state of Utah, especially around the wet areas. And my voice is going. Sorry about that. I also talked with Melissa Burns, Migratory Bird Coordinator, the Utah Ecological Services, Wildlife Services, U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, and she said there have been no mentions of crow damage in Utah to her. In fact, she was quite concerned. Apparently, she wasn't real familiar with what was going on herself. That was just today. I talked with her. I have had conversations twice with Dr. Kevin McGowan, who is the crow guru. I would say he studied crows for 26 years at Cornell University, Ithaca. They have many more crows back there. I'm going to quote him. Studies do not indicate that they are a serious problem with crop grain. In New York, there is no indication that they are a serious problem with fruits, but maybe sometimes some predation on certain pecan orchards. Dr. McCowan also stated that depredation problems are minor where they occur and can easily be resolved by means other than having an annual crow hunt. He continued by saying that most states that have a crow hunt season, at least in the East, have a season based on sociological issues and not because of crow depredation. In other words, as he said specifically, in other words, it was because the local wildlife clubs requested it. Because before the laws were passed, the Migratory Bird Treaty Act of 1972, which brought the crow into possibly being hunted, because of pressure on U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, they finally bent in and allowed crow hunting. Now, what is on the menu for crows? Personal communication with Dr. Kevin McGowan, May 8th. Some early 1900s studies show that economic benefits are positive for crows via the substantial numbers of harmful insects eaten. For example, in cornfields, the corn borer larvae in the base of corn stalks are eaten in substantial numbers, and the studies show that in fields that had crows in them during winter months had better yields the following summer. U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, U.S. Biological Survey bulletins, several of those have mentioned crow diets, and they come out generally positive for crows because of the insects that they eat. I could read much more of this on crow diet, but I just wouldn't have time to do it.
Mr. Whaley, you have 1 minute.
1 minute left? Okay. Number two issue that has been brought up, the sociological issue. Blair Stringham this is a quote again from Blair Stringham. Giving hunters another chance to hunt is the major reason for wanting to start a crow hunt. This is the wrong reason for a crow hunt. Because other states are doing it does not mean it's the right thing to do. This is a non-consumptive crow hunt, no matter what people say. There may be some recipes out there on the internet, but they're not going to be eaten.
Okay, would you conclude your remarks, please?
I don't think I've had 5 minutes yet.
Yeah. Been five and a half.
Well, the last thing here is that the crows are now very common. Where's the data? We need data before we can start a crow hunt. Yeah, they're more common than used to be. We have four nesting birds in Utah County. That's it. They started nesting here in 2010, and I discovered the first nest, and have been studying those crows, that nest now for 4 years, and the other new test nests that we've now got, four of them now. These last 4 years, I've been noticed crow behavior, and those birds need to not be hunted. It's a very intelligent bird. I agree with everything she said. It's very important we avoid this hunt.
Okay, thank you. Our next comment's from Pam Petty.
Hello, I'm Pam Petty from Orem, Utah. I'm also here on behalf of the crows. They aren't able to represent themselves. They have an interest in living. I agree with everything in the previous two comments. They have families. They're individuals. They not only want to stay alive for themselves, but if they're killed, their families will miss them as well. The adult children help raise the younger children. There's just no reason. I was outraged when I saw in the Salt Lake Tribune that the main reason for having this crow hunt is to provide opportunities to hunt. That isn't a sufficient reason to kill, and that's the main reason I wanted to say that.
Thank you. Our next comment is from Rod Andrew. You gonna hold on that? Okay. All right. Comment from Great Basin Wildlife Rescue. Would you state your name when you get to the mic, please?
Patty Richards. And I just wanted to come up and say we're opposed to the crow hunt also. In the rehab process, you can tell the amount of species that are out there by how many come in for rehabilitation purposes, like a great horned owl. We get plenty of them. So we know the species count is up. But in 10 years of doing rehab, I've only received one crow in Utah County. And so that can tell you that we just don't have it here. I also want to state that when on an educational permit, we do have a crow and a raven. And anytime I take my raven out, we always get the same question. What's the difference between a crow and a raven? People don't know. So that's all I wanted to say.
Okay, thank you. I want to do a question.
You already did that.
Yes. Okay. All right. Any other comments from the audience? Ken and then Mike.
Ken Strong, representing myself. I would like to take the time to thank the DWR for taking the time in investigating this crow hunt and looking at what happens in some of the other states and look at the hunting opportunities that it provides us here in this state. I think it's a very good thing to be able to hunt crows. I look at what goes on in the spring with them raiding the nests of the birds. I have them in my pine trees at home where the birds nest and the crows are enjoying the baby birds. We got the pheasant chicks, especially the sage grouse that are local here down west in Ephi, and that where the ravens really aren't as much as the crows are, and they're destroying what few sage hens we do have left, and that's an endangered species. So I would like to thank the Fish and Game for taking the time to think this out and offer the crow hunt, and I'm 100% behind it. Thank you.
Thank you, Ken. Mike.
Mike Pritchett, representing Sportsman Fish and Wildlife, and we support the division's recommendation on this crow hunt and would like the RAC to support it also. Thank you.
Thank you. Any other comments from the audience? Ben.
Thanks, Gary. Ben Lauder, representing Utah Bowman's Association this evening. We support the recommendation here on the waterfowl recommendations, including the crow hunt as presented. You know, the question's been asked, where's the data? We saw the data. The data shows an increasing trend in population, a very exponential increasing trend in population. We've seen just very recently in the last week, couple months, as we see other populations increase like this, we're asked to reduce them. Just last week, the cattlemen were asking us to reduce elk populations at the Wildlife Board meeting because elk populations are very high. We're currently asking the BLM to reduce horse populations because they are way beyond objective and out of control. And again, the data has been presented. The populations of crows are increasing, and as we have seen in the last 20, 25 years, very exponentially. I believe that there is room to hunt them. As well, hunting crows doesn't mean that we're going to wipe them out. Hunting is a management tool and used to manage populations and to keep them in a stable, healthy population. So I don't see any detriment to doing so. Thank you.
Thank you, Ben. Any other comments?
Any comment? Is that legal?
Well, I can only give you 5 minutes, and you used those already.
There's a lot to be said that hasn't been said.
That's true.
You need to talk to some people at Cornell University who studied these crows. The bird populations do not go down. Yes, western scrub jays eat birds' eggs and young, too. All the corvids do. You can talk to the people who study crows for many years, and the populations of birds are not affected. The songbirds are still here. The crows have been around for a long time. It's not like they suddenly appeared somewhere. I got crows in my yard every day because I feed birds, including crows. And I have robins nest there every year. Since 2010, the robins still nest there. What's going on?
Okay.
Sparrows are all over the place in my yard. I watch birds. I feed birds. They're here. So the idea that the crows are going to destroy other birds, and when I talked to Dr. Kevin McGowan at Cornell University, who is the crow guru, studying 20-some years, 26 years, we don't need this hunt. We do not need this hunt. It's unethical.
Okay.
Birds are very intelligent and family-oriented. It's not right.
Okay. We appreciate you and your efforts to make your point. You've made your point. Well, we run these meetings with the rules and regulations that everybody has to play by, and anyway, you've made your point. Thank you very much. Any other comments from the audience? All right, we'll bring it back to the rack. Richard.
Yeah, when this came out, I read about it, and I was wondering how you tell the difference between a crow and a raven, et cetera. But I talked with an individual that raises sheep, runs sheep, goes from the desert to the mountains every year. And he told me specifically that they lose several lambs every year to crows. As soon as those lambs hit the ground, those crows come in, peck their eyes out, and the lambs die. It happens. I'm not saying how much because I don't know if there's any studies, but he says he's seen it personally happen many times, and they have to try to run this. Go, excuse me. Okay, I'm just giving a comment that was given to me by someone that raises sheep and has done so for over 30 years. So I'm just saying they do cause some problems. Let's just be honest about it. Just like anything does, okay? And so I think that needs to be part of the record here too, that they do cause problems, and they are, I don't know what their natural predators are or if they have any or if it's just disease only that keeps their numbers in check. So, but I wanted to enter that comment from someone that has dealt with that situation. Thank you.
Thank you, Richard. Any other comments or Sarah?
I just want to clarify that the chart that you had up there with the growing population, you did mention that you really don't have solid numbers for that. That was just an inference that you... Can you clarify your comment? Because I thought I heard you say that was what you think is happening, not what you know for sure.
No, so that actually comes from the Breeding Bird Survey data, which is done each year in the spring. And so it tracks the breeding trend of many different bird species. And so that, I mean, that's definitely data. Yeah.
Any other questions or comments from the RAC? All right. I'll entertain a motion to the suggestion.
I'll make a motion to accept as presented.
Motion is made by Chris, seconded by Larry. Jay, sorry. All in favor? Opposed? Okay. The motion passes. 7 in favor, 2 opposed. Our next item is also an action item. It has to do with the Utah Trail Hunter Program. It's the new rule R657-68. Kirk Smith, the Hunter Education Coordinator, will speak to it.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Kirk Smith. I'm the Utah Hunter Education Coordinator. What I'm here to present tonight is the Trial Hunting Program Rule R657-68. I do have quite a few slides here with some graphs on and stuff, so if you want to rearrange so you can see it good. What I'll cover in this presentation is a background of this program and highlights of what the new program will consist of. Brief background of the program. Over the years, hunting populations as far as participants has declined dramatically over the year. A study that was done in 2001 shows that for every 100 hunters that are leaving and not continuing to hunt, the national average of replacement ratio was only 69. Utah, our average was 59. So we're not returning or we're not replacing hunters as fast as they're leaving in the state of Utah. So with that, Utah has put a lot of effort into opportunity. We've lowered the hunting age. We've expanded youth opportunity through youth-only hunts for elk, for waterfowl, chucker. We've increased the established percentage of permits, certain permits on big game, grouse, turkeys, and crane that go specifically to youth. The deer hunting, youth are allowed to hunt all three seasons on the general hunt. We've implemented a hunter mentoring program last year where youth have the opportunity to use a relative's big game tag or permit. And as you can see, we're continuing to expand opportunity by recommending three-day youth hunts rather than just a one-day hunt. Looking at the demographics of the age of adult hunters, at 16, 17-year-old age, that youth age, we got 5%. You can see it increases. We hit a peak at 35 to 44 years old, and then it declines again. I just show you this slide to put things into perspective of these age groups of 18 through 34 years of age. The growth rate by age group, the 18 to 24, that's our slowest growth rate. The next would be the 16 to 17 and then the 25 to 34. So you see as we're getting into those early 20 years and into the mid 40s, our growth rate is really stagnant. It's actually declining considerably within that age group.
So what the division's been doing, we've been looking at programs around the state, around the country, to address this issue of declining hunters and their replacement rate. We've monitored programs in other states that are happening with that throughout the country. One of these programs that this particular program addresses is a try before you buy type program, where you can try it before you take a formal hunter education class. Currently, there's 35 other states that offer this type of program. They are very family friendly. They have an exceptional safety record, and they definitely generate support for wildlife conservation. Here's a map of the states that are currently offering the program in the dark color, the light color, the white. Do not have that program in place. Arizona is in the process of implementing this program this year. What does a trial apprentice hunting, or what type of people does it attract? This was a study done in Minnesota. Resident hunters, 72% of them lived outside of the Twin Cities. And with this apprentice hunter program, you can see a huge increase in that urban hunter introduction into hunting. It also attracts women. With a lot of the split families that we have nowadays, women aren't introduced to hunting in the traditional manner as it was 20, 30, 40 years ago. So this trial hunting program introduces it to women in a readily available manner. What happens to the trial hunter as far as purchasing licenses and continuing on? This is based on a three-year trial hunter program. Within the second year, 44% of the participants go ahead and they take a regular hunter education course. They've decided, hey, this is what I want to do. So rather than just riding out the try before you buy, they go ahead and enroll in a course and take hunter education. The third year, an additional 25% plus jump on board, to where we've got 75% of them that enrolled within 3 years are now hunters. Based on a survey done in Minnesota, they asked those participants, would you have hunted without the trial hunter program? 50% of them said no. 26, not sure. So this is a very effective way to introduce people into the hunting community. What does it do for license sales? Since 2006, there's been over 1 million apprentice hunting licenses sold. And so with the return rate that you're seeing, they're sticking around. So in 2014, the Utah State Legislature passed Bill 165, which allows a person to obtain certain hunting licenses or permits prior to taking formal hunter education. It allows us to create a trial hunting program. What the bill, the legislature set in place, is the minimum age. 11 years old can apply for hunts, 12 year old and older can hunt. It also set the supervising hunter requirements, that person has to be 21 years of age or older. This program is also available through legislation to residents and non-residents. Some highlights of the new program, what we're proposing. Participating in the program would be for anyone born after December 31st, 1965. And this is based on current code. Anyone born prior to that day is not required to have hunter education to hunt in Utah. Maintain the 11-year-old age for application purposes. They must be 12 before they can hunt. Complete a brief online questionnaire. As we work through this process of how do we keep track of these individuals that are trial hunters, working with our IT department within Wildlife Resources, we established that a questionnaire online would be a good trigger point to start that clock ticking to know when their time is up as far as enrollment in the program. Once they complete that questionnaire, they'll receive a trial hunting authorization number in lieu of their hunter education number. That will be used in their application process and on their licenses. What licenses and permits would be available to the trial hunter? We're proposing any hunting license excluding the multi-year, combination license also excluding the multi-year, hunting permits excluding some big game permits. The next slide, I'll go into detail on those. We also would like to propose that this trial hunting authorization would meet the hunter education requirement for the hunter mentoring program, so they could actually participate in both of these. The licenses and permits that would be excluded are these big game permits allocated through a drawing. Premium limited entry, once in a lifetime, CWMU permits, dedicated hunter, sportsman permits, and also this would include convention permits that include the premium limited entry, and once in a lifetime. The term of the program would be one once-in-a-lifetime, three-year term. So they could only do it once, and they could do it for up to 3 years. After completing hunter education, say they get into their second year and they decide, hey, I want to take hunter education and start applying for the limited entry and those that are excluded, they would terminate their tenure in this program and be able to apply for the regular hunts. Hunting as a trial hunter, 12 years of age or older, they must possess a current hunting license, combination license, and appropriate permits. So they have to purchase their own permits and be in possession of those. They must be supervised in the field at all times as defined in Code 2320 and 20. That code refers to the youth supervision on our current hunting. We're expanding that regardless of age. No matter how old the trial hunter is, they have to be supervised at all time. Supervising hunter responsibilities: provide direct supervision and instruction on safety, ethics, and hunting regulations. The ratio of the number of trial hunters per supervising hunter is 2 trial hunters per 1 supervising hunter. The supervising hunter must possess a valid hunting or combination license. They do not have to possess the same permit or license that the trial hunter is in possession of in hunting. They just have to have a hunting license. They must be 21 years of age or older, and must have written consent from parent or guardian of a minor trial hunter. Is it safe? That's been the biggest question and the biggest discussion throughout the state. As the hunter education coordinator, I travel around the state each spring and I get all of our hunter education instructors together. We have 450 hunter education instructors currently in Utah. I presented this to them, and we had some very open discussion and some very open concerns about the safety end of things. And this study that Families of Field has done, they compile the information on hunting incidents. And as you can see, apprentice hunters are 4 times safer than licensed hunters. Regular licensed hunters. And this is based on that direct supervision at all times while they're out in the field. So in summary, what we're proposing for the trial hunting program, these permits would be the excluded permits listed there. The term of the authorization would be once in a lifetime. The number of years would be 3 years. 2-to-1 on the ratio of trial hunter versus supervisor, and the application process would be through the DWR website. And that's all I have. Thank you.
Thank you, Kirk. Do you have any questions or points of clarification from the RAC?
I got a question.
Chris?
Did Trial Hunter accrue preference points?
No. No, we did not include that in there.
Okay. That's what I was looking for. I didn't see it at all. Thank you.
Richard?
Did you consider, though, if it's a Trial Hunter and they're over the age of 14, allowing them to accrue a preference point, though?
That was discussed very heavily through the whole process of doing that, and we decided to exclude that at this point.
I just wonder if that would encourage them to stay in it.
Okay. Yeah. Now. All right. What kind of where we're at, and I just received a note here. It said the legislature allows us to have a Trial Hunter program. They actually directed us to do so. It wasn't something they said you guys should think about this. They directed us to do it. So that's kind of where this one lies, and that might help clear up some of the questions or wonderings about where it's coming from and all of that. But they've been directed to bring it up and to do it. Any other questions from the RAC? Usually. Usually.
Well, I think it's more a thing of how to structure it. They want us to do it, and it's up to these guys just to structure it and how we're going to do it.
About it was the safety. You know how little kids are, or you know how adults are, that are not used to guns and stuff, but the safety record speaks for. They're a little more careful. Maybe the mentors were a little more conscientious because they're aware of the what's at risk, but that's. We've been directed to figure out a way to make it work, is what it sounds like to me.
That is correct. And this is on the screen now. That I summarized, those are the key points that the Wildlife Board has got to make a decision on of how we're going to run this program.
That's helpful.
I think the other concern I'd heard from people when it was talked about was they were concerned about the draw permits, you know, the premium permits and stuff like that, where these people have an opportunity to get in on that. And yes, they would if they do the hunter safety and go the regular route, but not just as a trial hunter.
Correct. The limited entry, the highly coveted permits.
They're all highly coveted.
Are protected from this program.
Any questions from the audience? I have one comment card. Ben Louder.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ben Louder representing the Utah Bowman's Association. We supported this, the legislative piece of this one, went through the legislature this spring. A couple of comments. The best way to introduce somebody, get somebody hooked into an activity or a sport is to let them participate. We can talk about it all we want, and it can generate excitement, but until you participate, that's when people really get hooked. The Hunter Education Program, while definitely a very good program and necessary, places a barrier in front of hunting and allowing us to introduce new people to hunting. This program removes that barrier in a very safe way and safe manner and provides people the opportunity to introduce people to hunting that may not otherwise do so. We support this presentation as it has, or this proposal as it has been presented. I think that the bullet points you see here on the screen with the licenses and the permits that are and are not allowed as part of this program is a very good compromise, and we support it as presented. Thank you.
Thank you, Ben. Any other comments from the audience? Okay, we'll bring it back to the rack for your... Richard.
You know, since I've been on this board, I've seen a lot of effort made to try to engage the youth and to bring them into the hunting community. And I've often thought that sometimes we just bend over backwards to do it, to try to get them there. And then I see the graph that shows where you're losing them, you know, the ages and that sort of thing. And I think a lot of it is because of old guys like me that told our kids, man, I remember the day. I remember going out and seeing 100 deer in one day. And now you take my grandkids out, and sometimes we're lucky to see 2 does in a day. You know, and I know the division is working their tails off to try to make that experience better. You know, the deer herd seem to be trending up, things like that. And I think that's the thing that's going to make them get hooked. It's when they go out and they can have some success and see that, that'll keep them hooked. And along with that, I'm a little concerned about the fact that we don't let these 12-year-old kids at least buy bonus points for limited entry species hunts. You do that, they'll stay in the game. That's my opinion. Okay, so I would hope that they would at some point try to look at that and at least allow those 12-year-olds to apply at least for bonus points for deer, elk, and make them feel like they got a little skin in the game. So if they stay with it, they'll eventually be able to draw that permit, and they won't kind of just fade off because it's like, what's the point, you know? And so, anyway, I'd like to maybe consider that at some point. Thanks.
That would be this November.
Any other comments from the RAC?
Yeah.
Chris.
I got a comment. I like what Richard had to say. Maybe not let them use them, obviously, until they go through hunter safety and all in that, but I like the idea of buying the bonus points and having those as an additional hook to say, okay, and maybe even write the rule to say after your 3-year expiration period, if you don't take hunter safety and get into it, then you lose those bonus points. But I kind of like that idea.
Any other comments?
I think we need to clarify something.
Okay.
You mind? You know, we've got another group, 12 to 14, that can't apply for limited entry, sure. You know, that have hunter education. So I think if you're going to take this up, it would be at the big game, you know, the November meeting where we would change the rules for the whole group, not just
who. Well, we could take it, say, 14 instead of 12, right? For the 12. Trial program. To say if you're over 14, you could.
Well, they can't
buy a bonus point.
That I guess you could, because that wouldn't complicate things,
right.
With the yeah.
That's good clarification.
That would be related to this rule,
right.
And not the big game rule coming
right.
Up in November.
Right.
So what you just said was at 14 is when you can start accumulating points.
I don't know about having trial hunters accumulating points. I mean, I think they ought to be legit, have gone through hunter safety and done the stuff that everybody else had to do to start to acquire points. I don't think as a trial hunter you should have the opportunity to do that. That's just my opinion.
I was really focusing on that 12 to 14-year-old age. It's already went through hunter safety, because right now they can't.
So that's
I think you just tie them into it more if they're able to at least buy a bonus point for a particular species. So
that'd be the November.
Yeah.
All right.
That's
yes.
I like the aspect of encouraging them to go on with hunter education, the formal licensing thing, rather than trial hunt. Say, okay, now if you want to get the points, this is where you have to go.
I agree.
I like that approach.
I agree.
So I thought you did a really good job responding to the direction that they got from the legislature and coming back with a program we can live with.
Thank you.
Is that a motion?
We'd like to entertain a motion.
Before we do, I'd like to just see if this has any legs. So I'd like to make a motion for one amendment. Any trial hunter over the age of 14 can purchase bonus points towards these off-limits hunts. And if they complete hunter safety by the end of their trial period, they can keep those bonus points. That's the amendment I would like to propose. I don't know if everybody understands that. I just want to see if that had legs.
For a second.
I'll second it.
Okay, motion by Chris, seconded by Richard. Motion is to, if somebody's a trial hunter and they actually formalize it with the hunter safety and stuff within the three-year period, that they would be allowed to buy bonus points and they'd be able to keep those bonus points that they had bought. And then
I think you're going to have to restate it.
Okay, so the motion that I'd like to propose is that any trial hunter participant age 14 or older can purchase bonus points. And as long as they complete hunter safety before the end of their trial period, they can keep those bonus points. If they don't, they would lose them. That's fine. Well, you got 3 years to complete it.
They get one trial tag, right? No, but they could get it each year.
They can get it each year?
12, 13.
Okay. Motion's been made. It's been seconded by Richard. All in favor? All opposed? Motion dies. Is that the right word?
It just didn't pass.
Didn't pass. Didn't die, but it didn't pass.
If you really didn't like it, you could say it died.
Okay.
Motion to
Timothy.
Accept the project or proposal as presented by the board.
This motion made by Timothy to accept the proposal as presented by the board, seconded by Larry. All in favor? Motion passes unanimously. Our last item tonight is an informational item having to do with the Least Chub Refuge site at the Salt Lake County Jail, and that'll be Chris Crockett presenting that.
Strawberry action plan.
Did I miss one?
You skipped the strawberry management plan. We can go to him first since he's on the list.
Okay.
Crockett's got to wait for his ride home anyway.
I missed one. Sorry about that.
I guess they flipped and you're up.
I just go work all.
Yeah, you see that. Yeah. No, I just...
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Chris Crockett. I'm the Native Aquatics Project Leader for the Central Region here in Springville. Just an informational item. Wanted to give you an update on a project we're working on to establish a Least Chub Refuge site in Salt Lake City. This is pretty similar to a project that you heard last year, just in a different location. A little bit of background information. Probably everyone here knows what a least chub is, but if not, we'll give you a quick little update. It's a small minnow, small little fish. It's endemic to Utah. It's only found in 6 populations throughout the Bonneville Basin. We only have 6 populations remaining worldwide, and they're all here in Utah. So to Utah wildlife, it's a pretty important little guy. Historically, it occupied several springs and wetlands throughout the Wasatch Front and the West Desert. It is a state-sensitive species, and in 2010, it was petitioned a list under the Endangered Species Act. The ruling by Fish and Wildlife Service came back that listing was warranted, but precluded due to higher priorities. Essentially, Fish and Wildlife Service said, it may be in trouble, but we have bigger fish to fry. There was a leash trove conservation agreement and strategy established in 2006 to help guide the management. We have several signatories to that, including Fish and Wildlife Service, DWR, BLM, Forest Service, and some of the other land management agencies. That included several different components to help guide management. One of those is the establishment of refuge populations throughout the Bonneville Basin. And when I say refuge population, essentially what we're talking about is a backup population. So if you only have six of them worldwide, you want to get a few extras out there, so if something catastrophic were to happen to one of those, that you don't have all your eggs or all your fish in one basket. Just a quick overview, these yellow dots indicate the natural populations that still remain in Utah. We do have three located in the central region. One there at Mona Springs around the town of Mona, a second in Mills Valley near the town of Mills, and a third just barely in our region out in the West Desert at the Leland Harris Wetland Complex. That's out around Trout Creek, Partoon area. The triangles that you see indicated there in red represent some of the areas where we've already established some refuge populations. And so you see quite a few dots up there, but what we're trying to do is establish...
May I have your attention, please? The time is now 8:45 and the library will be closing in just 15 minutes. If you have items for checkout or require assistance, please come to the front at this time where we'll be happy to help you. Thank you and have a good night.
So don't be alarmed, that's pretty common. They always try to close the house down when I start talking. So, triangles that represent where we already have refuge populations, and you'll see there's quite a few of them. We're trying to establish at least two backups for each of those six natural populations. So a little more detail on the project description. We're looking to do a partnership with Salt Lake County Sheriff's Office. They have some property just adjacent to their facility there on 3300 South. This is really just kind of a part of a larger project to establish an area there where they can not only give back to the community, hopefully give back to wildlife, but also provide some job training opportunities for the inmates as part of their programs there. From the wildlife standpoint, we are looking to create a genetic refuge population of these leash chub, specifically the Mona Springs population. We hope these will serve as a brood stock, so provide us extra fish that we can stock back into our wild populations, use them for educational purposes. We've got some leash chub going into classrooms where they can get, where they can be used as part of the curriculum for fourth and sixth graders. We're working a little bit more with some of the mosquito abatement districts to provide fish for them. And as I alluded to, this is also part of a program to provide education and job training opportunities for inmates. I should point out that some of the educational training opportunities, we're getting a lot of assistance from the University of Utah. They have a Center for Science and Math Education that will be integral to helping in this larger program. We will establish an agreement with Salt Lake County and Fish and Wildlife Service, really just clarifying what everyone's roles are and what the jail's options are if the species were to be listed. They would have the option to essentially say, we no longer want those there, we'd go in and take them out, or they could enter into a Connecticut conservation agreement that would be a little bit more of a formal agreement that outlines what they've agreed to and, again, what our role is in that process. Lots of partners, Salt Lake County Sheriff's, University of Utah, and we're also doing a lot of work with Salt Lake County Parks and Recreation to assist this. It was presented by the Sheriff's Office to the Salt Lake County Council. It did receive support from them, received an initial pot of money to help with the planning process. Once we do have that final review, we will run it through RDCC. Next steps, we will be working on finalizing that MOU. We are still awaiting the design of the facility. And if we can get that done in the fall, then we will be subsequently stocking approximately 5,000 leash chub. We'll keep an eye on and monitor them every year, see how many we can take out for some of those projects, education, mosquito abatement that I alluded to. Thanks to all our participants. The Sheriff's Office has been really helpful in this. Sheriff Wender, Pam Lofgren, Matt DeMont, and Emily Grange from the University of Utah. If you have any questions, comments, or suggestions as we go forward with this project,
I would love to hear them.
Are they going to cover that pond so it's not just snacks for migrating birds?
That will be part of the inmate's role in the process, is helping with some of the scare tactics, essentially, for preventing that, yes. But we won't actually cover it, but we will have that as part of the plan.
All right. Questions or points of clarification from the RAC? Do we have any questions or points of clarification from the audience? Any comments from the audience? Comments from the RAC?
I'd like to make a motion to accept as presented.
Motion's been made by Chris. Oh, it is. Okay. Yeah, sorry.
Excellent. My apologies.
It's a good thing I kind of led you there. Sorry about that.
No worries. Thank you.
I think to get people who are stuck in a place for a while doing something meaningful and worthwhile is a good idea. It's always a good idea. So I think this is a great idea.
They could use the help of the mosquitoes.
Yes, they could. Yes, they could. So if they got the least chub going good, would that null that 100-year flood zone regulation they have on the Gambezis? So you could put least chub anywhere since they were native. Would that release that?
Right. That's exactly what's been the goal with our cooperation with mosquito abatement districts is, Gambusia, although they do a pretty good job of controlling mosquitoes, are pretty detrimental to a lot of our other native species. So the least chub in the same numbers do almost as well, but we're still trying to get to the point that we can produce as many as easily. And so that's where a pond like this could come in. Is we'd like to get it where we could eventually just provide those fish directly to the public in Salt Lake, not to exclude the mosquito abatement districts, but to kind of make their lives a little more easily.
Right.
A little easier, excuse me.
Good plan. Any other comments from the RAC? Okay.
Thank you.
Our next board meeting will be on June 5th. No, I didn't get it on my original list.
Closing slide, if you want.
All right. Next one's also an informational item. It's the strawberry management plan. Alan Ward, the strawberry project leader, is going to direct this one.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Justin Robinson. I'm the strawberry project biologist. Alan Ward, our project leader, could not make it tonight, so I'm going to give the presentation.
This is informational only, right?
Yes.
Okay, just making sure.
Yeah, no, I won't ask you to make a motion. I think that's a good idea. Sorry.
Just to give you a little bit of background, the last fisheries management plan for the Strawberry Valley was written up in 1987, just prior to the last rotenone treatment. We use these plans, as you know, to guide our fisheries management decisions. And with strawberry, we started to notice that some of the goals were very outdated, especially on ideas of stream spawning, a few things like that. So as a project, we decided that it was time to reevaluate the plan. We went with kind of the new division format. We started a committee. We tried to bring in as many partners, interested groups, government agencies at all levels, and all the way down to business and just user groups. And we were very successful in this. We had 17 different groups participate, representing public, private, and government. I'd like at this point to thank John and Mike Slater, John Fairchild. They acted as facilitators. And because of that, we were able to get this process done in about 6 3-hour meetings, which was pretty interesting with as many people as participated. They did a really good job. I'm just going to go straight through the goals and objectives. I have our guiding statement at the top: protect and enhance the unique year-round angler experiences that Strawberry Reservoir provides as one of Utah's premier cold water fisheries. I tried to get the in there instead of one, but I was talked out of it. I wasn't diplomatic enough. Sorry. But these are the four main goals that the group came up with. I really enjoyed this process. As the biologist, I didn't put in any input. I brought data. We have done angler opinion surveys statewide and at the reservoir. Of course, we have all of our data that we gather every year. We were able to bring those, give it to the group, and let them come up with this. So these are their ideas. Obviously, the number one concern at Strawberry is chubs. We want to make sure they do not cause us the problems that they have in the past. And then, of course, as soon as we can take care of the biology of the reservoir, let's make the best fishery we possibly can, and as different of a fishery as we can. If there are other...
The time is now 8:55. We'll be closing in 5 minutes. Please make your final selections or get the rep check out. Thank you.
I'm not going to hurt. At that point in time, we want to ensure a variety of fishing experiences. We've seen that statewide with what the anglers have been asking for, as many different things as they can possibly get. And as long as it'll fit into Strawberry, we should provide those experiences. And then also, because Strawberry is so large, and also because it receives so much angling pressure, there was really a push from the group to make sure that we could save as much money in our hatchery system as possible, and the best way to do that was through natural reproduction of our naturally reproducing sport species. As we start down through the objectives, I'll go through them fairly quickly, but there was a lot of discussion on strategies. At some point in time, we will be sending out this plan. It's in the draft stage near completion. It just has to have a little bit of review. And then the write-up, the plan itself, will come out. That lists the strategies that were presented by the group, but I'm not going to discuss those here. So the objective one is, again, this is to prevent chub. We know from our data that there are certain sizes and numbers of cutthroat that we need in the reservoir. So these goals, the goal basically is to produce enough cutthroat to keep the chub populations down. One big part of that is to get survival out of our young and stocked fish. So what this is looking at is the idea that we need to maintain daily growth rates. This is how we know our young fish are healthy. A lot of these objectives to meet the goals were presented based on what data we're able to obtain, so that we can actually go out with our sampling, know that that we are meeting this goal without having to start a new monitoring program. Objective two, limit total catch of chubs sampled in the gillnet survey to 1 per net hour. This is just basically so that we have a metric to tell us that if we know we're below 1 chub per net hour, we're not having a current chub problem. And objective three, maintain those large fish in the reservoir, the ones that are very good at eating chub but are also still young enough that they have a high population. These are really the fish that are controlling the chub for us, so we need the cutthroat in there 18 inches, and we need them at a certain number. Goal two, again, high quality diverse fishery and associated habitats. Objective one, meet or exceed water quality standards. One of our partners was the Division of Water Quality, the Utah Division of Water Quality, and they wanted to make sure that we were doing our part in making Strawberry as clean a reservoir as it can be, and of course that'll help all the biota. Objective two, maintain a catch rate. People associate catch rate with quality, and So we wanted to make sure we had over 0.5 fish per hour. That is basically what we've been maintaining in our last three krills. The average of our last three krills was 0.47. So we would be looking for a slight increase and then maintenance from there on out. Objective three, average size of cutthroat trout in the gill nets. We're already, of course, gill netting, so this is something that we can actually look at. And this is, again, a quality metric. We know from our surveys that anglers think that a fish should be over a certain size. And we know that based on if we have cutthroat at 18 inches and larger, we're providing a quality fish to the anglers. Objective four is the same sort of thing for the rainbows. The rainbow, we wanted to look at the krill because we see what the anglers are harvesting. And so that gives us a little bit tighter reference for how well we're doing. Goal three, ensure a variety of fishing experiences. We figure that if we can maintain 1.2 million angler hours, or actually that's a slight increase from where we are in the last three krills averaged, that we will be proving that we have ensured a lot of variety, and that's drawing the anglers. Again, maintain at least 200,000 ice angler hours per year. Ice angling is becoming more and more popular. The group felt that this was important to separate from just overall pressure, because this is a place they felt that we could increase our usage. Objective three, explore potential for increasing fishing opportunities on strawberry tributaries. Right now, because of the importance of the natural reproduction, we have we have some fairly restrictive regulations on our tribs. We have been asked to look into this and see if there is any way we could loosen that. And there are some potentials, some timing and streams that we could potentially open up just to see if people will use them and see that as another fishing experience. And then also enhance non-angling opportunities. We see this with our kokanee and cutthroat days. We have a lot of people come up to see the kokanee. We want to maintain that and expand those sorts of opportunities, bring as many people to Strawberry Valley as possible, whether they're there to fish, whether they're there with fishermen or just new folks. The last, improve natural reproduction of cutthroat and kokanee. Right now, we have an estimate of about 90,000 cutthroat age one that have come from natural reproduction. We would like to increase that. That's something that we can actually put a finger on and say within 10 years, we are going to increase that by about a little over 50%. One thing that lends itself to this is the amount of stream restoration we're doing on Strawberry River. Some of that work is now 12 years old. We should be starting to see some returns from that investment and effort. And this will push us to kind of quantify that and keep going whenever we have opportunities. And then lastly, objective two, explore opportunities to expand kokanee salmon populations and natural recruitment. We've been hearing a lot that people would like to catch more kokanee salmon to have, you know, not detract from the gorge, but maybe have another opportunity on the level of the gorge for kokanee fishing. And we need to look into ways that we can expand kokanee in strawberry numbers, catch rates, those sorts of things. So I went through that fairly quickly. If there is anything that somebody would like to spend more time on discussing any of those strategies, I'd be happy to. Thank you.
Questions from the rack? Questions from the audience? Great. Comments from the rack? Comments from the audience? Thank you.
Joe Rohner, I'm representing myself, but I am a member of the Strawberry Anglers Association.
Okay.
And I'd like to go on record as supporting Justin and Alan in their plan for the Strawberry Valley and thank them for what they've done.
All right. Thank you. Any other comments? All right. Well, thank you. We appreciate your presentation and your time. Board meeting that will address these items that we've discussed tonight will be on June 5th at 9 a.m. in the DNR boardroom, right there on North Temple. Our next RAC meeting is August 5th. So,
enjoy the summer.
Yes. Meeting's adjourned.